Welcome to another edition of the Thoroughbred Daily News Writers Room Podcast. My name is Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Randy Moss with NBC Sports and the Byers Speed Figure team.
Zoe Cabman here with XBTV and First Racing. If I'd known we were going all Christmassy, I'd have worn my Christmas jumper.
So this is a special edition of the Thoroughbred Daily News Writers Room. It is our best of 2024. We're trying to give some of our employees a couple weeks off and a little bit of rest time as the holidays coming up. So we hope you enjoy this because we're going to give you the what we thought were some of the best interviews that we compiled this year in 2024. So sit back and enjoy. This should be fun.
So back in June, just prior to the first ever Belmont Stakes at Saratoga, we interviewed Richard Migliore, the former jockey and now racing analyst for Fox Sports. We asked Richie about his expectations for that historic four-day meet and about his opinions on the Belmont Stakes in particular.
Welcome in now, the Green Group guest of the week, and it's an old favorite of mine, Richard Migliore, a guy who'd had a great career as a jockey and is doing, I say, just as well as a TV commentator now, as he's part of the Fox program that will be airing the Belmont Stakes on Saturday. Richie, welcome and thanks for joining us here on the TDN Writers Room podcast. I always wondered about this. You are a New York guy, New York through and through. You root for all the New York sports teams. You were born and raised in New York. How would you compare? You were never lucky enough to win the Belmont or the Derby, but would you have rather won the Belmont than the Derby?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, you know, the easy answer would be the Derby because that's the first thing people ask you. Did you ever win the Kentucky Derby? And I was fortunate. I won a lot of Derbies. I would have traded them all for one Kentucky Derby. But honestly, the Belmont and the Travers probably held more allure to me. The Kentucky Derby for me growing up could have been, you know, on Mars. I was going to Aqueduct for races like the Sport Page Handicap and the Toboggan. Those were tangible to me, but it would have been nice to win any one of them. Unfortunately, it wasn't in the cards.
So, Richie, what are you expecting the scene to be like with the Belmont Stakes run at Saratoga for the very first time?
I can already feel the energy that's been in town. I got up here Saturday morning. I ran back home for one day, but you know, Saratoga always holds that kind of energy and you feel the charm of it, the mystique of Saratoga, but it's amped up even more here. I don't want to say it's going to be a madhouse, but it's going to be on the edge of chaos. I'm excited about it. Listen, Saratoga to me is America's classic racetrack, obviously home to the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame. So much history here and you could feel the history. It's palpable. And now we're having an American Classic. And I know a lot of people are upset. Oh, it's not a mile and a half. Well, the Belmont Stakes have been run at five different distances at five different locales already. So yes, in the modern era, there's tradition about it, but you know, the more things stay the same, the more things change.
Mick, where are you right now? It looks like you're in a very green place. Would you happen to be on a picnic table somewhere?
I am at a picnic table right outside the paddock. I bombed in here. Bees are buzzing me. And I just felt bad. I hate telling somebody I'll be ready at 12 and not be ready, you know, until after. I hate being late. I'm a very punctual kind of guy.
That being said, is it possible to still get a reservation in Saratoga? Because this weekend to me seems like, is it a little bit busier than Travers weekend? Because that's only thing I compare it to.
Yeah, it's even busier. You have to go as far away as Albany or up towards Lake George to find a hotel room that you could get for any one of the days. There's still tickets for Thursday, Friday, Sunday here at Saratoga. Saturday's completely sold out. But yeah, no, even dinner reservations. Luckily, Zoe, I have friends that are in the restaurant business up here, and I will be picking up takeout every night.
Richie, one of the biggest differences, not only that the race is being run in Saratoga as opposed to Belmont, but is the difference in the distance of the race, which you mentioned earlier, from a mile and a half to a mile and a quarter. There's no way they could have run this thing at a mile and a half at Saratoga. That would have made no sense. And anybody thinks it should be a mile and a half race. No, you're just wrong about that. But how about from a jockey's perspective? Will the riders ride this race any differently because it's a mile and a quarter at Saratoga versus a mile and a half at Belmont?
I do believe, Bill, they'll ride it differently. I think going a mile and a half, which is not a distance that is common in North America, particularly on the dirt, riders ride it much more carefully. They're much more inclined to worry about a horse getting the distance. A mile and a quarter, you know, a lot of these horses obviously have run in the Derby. They're not as going to be as concerned about the mile and a quarter. So I do believe they'll ride them a bit differently. I do think you'll see more of a legitimate pace, particularly in this Belmont, because there are three or four that I think are confirmed, not front runners, but forward type horses. So I do think it'll be ridden considerably different in that respect.
I'm one of those people who do think it should be run at a mile and a half, and I don't think I'm wrong about it, but I do understand why they're not, because it would be started on the turn. But let's talk about Sierra Leone, first of all, Richie. I mean, he's the horse that is going to be the favorite, probably a pretty solid favorite, I think. And a lot of the talk about Sierra Leone is obviously his Kentucky Derby and the lugging in, and now the jockey change and the bit change. Give us your opinion about all that.
Well, this is a horse, Sierra Leone, that has always shown that propensity to want to lug in. He did it in his first start. I think it cost him the Remsen Stakes because he lugged in on top of Doorknock, and it emboldened Doorknock. Every one of his starts, if you go back and look at his bluegrass, he's not running straight on his own volition. He's having to be corrected. And if you look at some of the still shots of the Derby, he has a snaffle bit, which, you know, Zoe will attest to, is a very mild bit in a horse's mouth. And it's basically pulled all the way through his mouth by Tyler Gaffleone, trying to keep him straight off of Forever Young and go forward. Now, they said they had experimented previous with that bit, and Chad Brown, his conditioner, wasn't thrilled with how he reacted to it. But since the Derby, he's worked in it three times. I was here for the last work. And it looks like it's having the desired effect. So, you know, obviously most people are too young to remember when cars didn't have power steering. Basically, he's outfitted with power steering now, as opposed to with that snaffle bit where he wasn't. I feel bad for Tyler Gaffleone. And let me, you know, couch this by saying, jockeys take off horses all the time to ride a horse they perceive as a better horse, right? Everybody's looking out for their best opportunity. So I'm never going to criticize an owner or trainer for doing what they think they need to do to see success. But I feel for Tyler Gaffleone in this instance because, you know, he rode the horse when it was more difficult to ride him. And now with this change of equipment, he doesn't get that opportunity. And as a former rider, I guess I'm a little sensitive to that. It just doesn't feel like it's 100% fair. Now, that being said, you know, if he could have rode a better one, he might have taken off. That's the nature of the business. I will say I'm a little bit, I question why he's never worked outside of horses with the new equipment. Every time he works on the rail. And as Zoe knows, a lot of these bigger, tougher kind of colts, a lot of the lugging is about getting over on top of a horse. They want to bully them. They're not as interested in running by them as they are to assert their dominance physically. And I really felt like Forever Young actually facilitated or started that contact and gave him probably 10%, and then he gave back 90%. But I think it kind of set him off a little bit. Like a horse came out into, you know, it's the guy in the bar, somebody brushes them and they're, you know, ready to jump and fight, right? I felt like that was a little bit what was going on with Sierra Leone. And I really do think he would have won the Derby if he could have been ridden properly. So you can make the case, I mean, he's two noses away from being undefeated, and you can make the case he should be undefeated. So I do think the bit will help a great deal, but I still would have liked to have seen him work outside of a horse that you would have gotten even a better idea of its effectiveness.
Couldn't agree with you more, Richie. I've been banging on about that for weeks, like work him on the outside. I believe he's trying to get to the rail as well. All right, Richie, put on your beret and put on your Frenchman's accent. Okay. I want you to take me through the race aboard Sierra Leone as if you are riding him. What does Flavien need to do?
Well, you know, a lot has been made of the trip beyond the bumping that, you know, he had to come wide. He saved ground all the first turn, and I'm a great believer in ground, saving ground. And if you're going to be wide, know you're going to be wide on one turn, you've got to make a conscious effort to be inside as much as possible on the other turn. So obviously you're on a closer. The first turn, you want to save as much ground as possible. He's also not a horse that you can stop and start, you know, much different than Mystic Dan, who is a ballet dancer, right? He can get up in a spot, idle, be asked, pick it up again. He can make multiple moves, which helps a rider out immensely. And it's going to lend himself to getting ground-saving trips and taking advantage of when opportunities present themselves. Sierra Leone is a completely different kind of horse, and he's a horse that runs with his head out and down. He's gotten bigger and stronger since the Derby, guys. I will tell you that. He's actually matured a great deal in these 5 weeks. And you think about it, they're like children. You know, they start to have growth spurts and develop at different stages. For a three-year-old colt, usually from the middle of January, end of January, through this period of time, they change a great deal. I've seen the most physical change in him than anybody else since the Kentucky Derby. But again, getting back to it, you can't stop and start him. So you've got to save as much ground on the first turn, in my estimation, if I'm riding Sierra Leone, and start to find my way to a clear path, whether that's inside or outside. But I want to put myself in a position where I don't have to stop him, because I don't think you're going to get him started again. You know, you think about driving a trail of my daughter to a horse show, right? And I've got horses on the back and I got my truck. If I hit the brakes, it takes me a long time to get my momentum going again. If I'm driving a Porsche, I can hit the brakes, stop, start, accelerate again. I think that would be the best way to describe the difference between Mystic Dan, who's a Porsche, and Sierra Leone, who's just more of a truck that once you get that momentum, you don't want to lose it. So I would be looking to get him as clear a trip as possible. I also, if I was riding him, I would have begged to work him. I would have drove up here from anywhere to get on him, so I had a better idea of exactly what I was dealing with.
So if you're riding him now and you're headed toward the stretch and you know his background, what's in the back of your mind?
Well, hopefully by then I'll have a better feel of how much control I have of him and make the decision to put him in the clear. I would prefer to be in the clear with a horse like that, but not if I'm having to fight him or correct him constantly. Because the more you're correcting, the less you're going forward, right? The finish line, the bag of money's up there. You know, if I'm going sideways, I'm inhibiting my ability to get to that bag of money.
You'll go to the Migliori patented left-hand crop.
Well, let's factor this in, guys. You know, we have different crop rules than we used to, and my contention with that has always been that, yes, I do think that riders need to be regulated and have a better education. You know, sometimes riders get caught up in going to the crop because they think that's what people need to see, as opposed to that it's actually being effective. But the limited amount of times, you've got horses with short attention spans, you got horses that lug in or lug out, you're limited by what you can do. And I think when you limit riders or you inhibit riders from reacting naturally to situations, you're not being fair to them. I've seen horses win by 5 lengths and get hit once that I think the rider should have been called in. I've seen horses stopping that a rider hits 3 or 4 times that should be called in. You are not allowing people to do their jobs and in the moment. And it's not like you have a lot of time to think about it. You have to be able to react and allow your instincts to take over. And I think it inhibits instinct. So, I think Flavien has to be aware of that too. I have 6 times that I could really get at this horse and, you know, How do I meet that out? How do I save it for crunch time? Do I get him early so I can get him away from horses and go forward? I think that's where sometimes I have trouble with some of these restrictions.
Richard Migliore, thank you so much for being our Green Group guest of the week. We'll be following you on the broadcast on Fox on Saturday for the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga. It's going to be a great event in the history of horse racing. No matter who wins, you're going into this knowing this is going to be something extremely special. And Richie, I'll be home watching you, and I'm sure you'll be telling the listeners all the good things that are going on. I want to thank you for being our Green Group guest of the week, and good luck on Saturday with your broadcast.
Thank you, guys. This was a lot of fun, and I'm obviously friends with all of you, but a big fan of all of you as well.
At Keeneland, a horse will always be measured in hands that see, that sense, that speak, hands that hold our sport to a higher standard, not for our sake, but for theirs, for the love of the horse, for generations to come.
You're seeing him on a skyrocket to success. He's really stamping his progeny, getting big, scopey, really good moving horses.
He moves your mares up so much. I think that reflects back in his versatility.
They do everything. They've got enough speed, and then they'll go two turns.
That can sprint, that can route, that can run on the turf.
I think he excels at a mile on the dirt and beyond.
It's all culminated into when they show up here, we all want them.
When you're at the barn and you walk out of the office, you see a shed row full of constitutions, it's always a good thing.
We also interviewed one of my favorite people in horse racing, and his name is Flavien Prat. Flavien, however you want to say it. In 2022, Flavien decided to make the decision, one that Bill didn't agree with, but he went anyway. He made the decision to leave Southern California to come east. And boy, did that decision pay off. In 2024, in Saratoga, he smashed the meet record with 16 stakes wins. We talked to him on the eve of the Saratoga meeting, which he would go on to dominate.
Now we're joined by our Green Group guest of the week. It's one of the hottest jockeys on the globe, Flavien Prat. Flavien, thanks so much for joining us. And first question I have for you is about the three-year-olds, which we're going to be talking a lot today, and the new shooter. You rode him for Chad Brown in an allowance victory Saturday at Aqueduct. He won very easily for the second straight time. What do you like about him? What is his future?
What I like about him, he's running fast. No, he has done everything right. He was before his first race, everybody liked him, and he was training well going into his first race. He ran well and came back even better and then ran a good race in Aqueduct.
Well, follow-up question for you on that. It was interesting. That was the same day that Catching Freedom ran as the favorite in the Ohio Derby. You had been riding him. What were the circumstances? Did you actually choose to stay in New York to ride Ultimate Wisdom, or was there more to the story than that?
No, it was one of those situations where it was either I was going to the Ohio Derby or I was, staying in New York and give a chance to see what Unmatched Wisdom could do. And I don't know, I just felt like I was going to try to, see what Unmatched Wisdom could do. And he ran a good race, so I was very pleased with that.
So, Flav, before we dive into some of the other stuff, let's keep it with the three-year-olds and talk Sierra Leone for a second. Okay, going into the Belmont, everybody knew about his lugging in situation, his habits, the bit change and things like that. And watching the Belmont Stakes, at one point, like about the 3/8 pole maybe, I'm like, my God, he's going to get beat 20 lengths. He's going absolutely nowhere. And then all of a sudden, belatedly, here he comes. What were your thoughts on the kind of race that he ran in the Belmont Stakes?
Well, I had pretty much the same thought as you. It seems like that day the track was pretty fast, and it was very hard to make ground. I was not traveling at all down the backside. I couldn't, it felt like the first quarter was quick, and I was okay where I was, and I was trying to, get him into a rhythm, and I figured once I get down the backside, I'll pick up a few horses, and as it goes, it'll start building momentum, but that was not the case. He was struggling to get some momentum, and he finally he finally turning form. He finally made a good run. So it was not as expected, but at the last part of the race was good, and so hopefully we can build something up for the future.
He's obviously got a huge amount of talent locked in there. So I mean, what's the solution? Not that he's running poorly. Is it just going to be maturity? I mean, what else can be done at this point?
I think, like I said, I don't think the track suited him that day. I don't feel like he was very comfortable on the track. So hopefully, he'll be able to go back to Saratoga. Usually in the summer, the track is a bit slower. And we'll go from there. I mean, see what happens.
Have you spoken to Chad Brown about a commitment for the ride back? Are you going to be riding him back in the Jim Dandy or Travers, or has that yet to be decided?
I don't know what Chad is going to do with him, but obviously he has a few options, and I'm sure I'll pick the right one.
Flavin, I want to switch subjects for a minute, but it's something that's so interesting to me. I want you to talk to us and give us a feeling of what it's like to ride Flightline. And how does that feeling aboard him feel different than virtually any other horse you've ever ridden?
Very small individual. It's very strange. It felt like he knew he was the star. He was obviously very fast. And could carry the speed for forever. I mean, for a mile and a quarter at least. So, he was very powerful. He had a great way of moving, well balanced, and he was very good in the turns. It felt like when he hit the turn, it was for whatever reason. I never moved on him on the turn, but for whatever reason, every time he swapped lead, He would pick up a length or two on everybody else, yeah.
And what was going through your mind in the Pacific Classic when you almost did a Ron Turcotte on Secretariat, where it looked like you looked behind you and almost couldn't believe that he was so far in front? Was that your reaction at the time?
It was if I recall, he ran the eight mile, and we're going from a mile to a mile and a quarter. He was running, I think, Country Grammar at the time. He was running against in the Classic. So, I felt that Country Grammar, could maybe make a run on us. So I'm down the backside, and, we get to the turn. So from there, I kind of let him run, and then took a peek behind and realized that all of a sudden we 20 lengths in front. So yeah, it was shocking. It was a very good feeling.
Well, without Flightline, Flavin, you've certainly kept the ball rolling. I mean, we're taping this on June 25th. Right now, you've made just a touch under $13.4 million in purse money. That's a record for your career at this stage of any year. You're practically riding first call for Chad Brown. You're in the Charlie Appleby barn. You're riding the best horse in the Bob Baffert barn. You're in with Brad Cox. I mean, things seemingly couldn't be going better. And I know in 2022, when you made the decision to relocate from Southern California to New York and Kentucky, it raised a lot of eyebrows. Looking back on that decision now, what do you think about it?
Gratefully, as you say, I'm riding for Great Connection. Very fortunate. My agent's doing a great job, and so everything is going well right now. I thought it felt like it was the right move at the right time. It was a time where I was in California for probably 6 or 7 years. And it just felt like it was time to, try to do something else and explore a little bit the East Coast. And I had the opportunity to ride for some trainer on the East Coast. And I thought it was just the right time to do it.
that did seem like a very natural progression for you, Flavien. Let's maybe roll the clock back a little further. You know, you started riding at age 16 in your home country of France. You were a champion apprentice the year later, and you only began riding in winters in Southern California in around 2009. And we look at the way your career has taken off and just blasted off since then. What do you wish, what do you know now with the experience that you've gained here in North America that you wish you knew when you were starting out? That was quite a bold move to be able to switch your tack from France to Southern California. What do you know now that you wish you knew then?
Well, that's a good question. No, I was when I was riding in France, everything happened very quickly. So I rode the first, I think the last 3 or 4 months of the season, and then I had a full season as an apprentice, and I was so best apprentice. And but it happened very quickly. I was very young. I don't think I was ready for that. You know, I was putting in position where a lot was expecting from me, and I don't think I was ready for that. But it was good because then I went to, you know, smaller racetrack. I was riding, you know, less quality horses, and I had to fight. I had, you know, earned my way, and it was hard. But it was a good thing because then I came here and I was starving, and I wanted to do well, and I think at that time then I was ready to do better.
Flavien, you have won a Kentucky Derby, of course, officially 2019 with Country House. But I've read that you really don't look at it that way, that it's sort of what we would call a hollow victory, of course, because he was put up through disqualifications. Do you feel that you're a Kentucky Derby winner already, or do you feel I still need to get my first real Derby win?
Well, I did win the Kentucky Derby, but obviously not in I mean, it's not how you want to win it. Like, you know, you don't cross the finish line first and all that thing. And hopefully, you know, I would be very fortunate if we can do that again. But, you know, regardless, yeah, I won the Kentucky Derby.
One of the things that we horse players have noticed, Flavien, is that, you know, more than you would expect, I think, for riders coming from Europe, particularly from France, you and in particular also Florent Giroux have mastered the art in this country of being aggressive early in races when the situation calls for it. How long did it take you to adjust that way to American racing, and do you see that as an advantage?
I don't know how long, and I probably still, you know, I mean, I'm still learning anyway, but, I came here and I didn't want to have that tag of a tough rider. That was a main, I didn't want that. I love dirt races. I think I'm a big fan of dirt races, and I didn't want to have that tag. So I did everything to make sure I was able to perform on the dirt. And I mean, obviously dirt races, you need to be aggressive at some point, and you need to put yourself in a good position, you know, going into the first turn. It's something that I always try to improve, that's for sure.
Flavien, as you continue to learn, you said you're always learning. Take a look back at the earlier stages of your career when you were trying to cement those habits and get them part of your routine and your makeup. Who was a jockey that was a great influence on you? And maybe what was the best piece of advice you ever got from a veteran rider?
I don't think there was one, run rider that I picked, but obviously, you know, you look at the, when I was in California, obviously Mike Smith, it's one of the riders that has one of the best palmares, and it was somebody that you know, I like to look at and very easy to talk to, and you know, can give you advice. But no, there's been a lot of, you know, rider that I watch, and but I'm not, there's not one in particular.
Flavien, it's interesting to me that, and maybe people don't all know this, you know, going way back in your career, you're the son of and from a family of standardbred trotting trainers. And that was mm-hmm. where you originally stood out. Two-part question. Why did you make the switch to thoroughbreds? And did you ever dream of winning the Prix de l'Amérique more so than the Kentucky Derby?
No, I love trotters. That's, you know, I've been around trotters all my as a kid, but I was very small, very light, and I felt like it could be a good. I always liked thoroughbred as a kid, and I thought, you know, if I can make it as a thoroughbred rider, I would like to try. And so before I went to the school, the jockey school, I went to two different trainers. And I spent 2 weeks with each, just to make sure I like it, and I did. And so then after that, I went to the jockey school, and that's about it. I just didn't want to the harness business. It's a lot family related, you know. A lot of people work with their parents and all that thing, and I just want to do my own thing. I want to do something different, and you know, be able to do my own thing.
Well, since things are going so well for you right now, Flavien, if you're ever tempted to ride in a charity harness race, ask around about what happened to Lafitte Pincai when he did that 34 years ago in 1990 and got thrown into the air like a rag doll and wound up breaking his collarbone and all sorts of other injuries. Be careful if you ever decide to do that.
I heard the story, but I did it last year in Saratoga. But I think Lafitte, when he drove a Pacer, and they have their four legs tied up. So I don't do that. I'll just stay with the harness, the trotters.
Flavien, you're riding right now at a very competitive time as far as the North American jockey colony is concerned, and you're riding New York, also spending some time shipping out to bigger races at other prominent tracks, wherever the grade one races are. Talk to us a little bit about your fellow riders, your rivals, your friends. Who is the one jockey that when you're going down, setting down a horse in the stretch, you don't want to either see coming after you, or you don't want to see that you have to reel in?
No, I think, as you said, there's a very good group of riders right now. I mean, you know, when you ride a race and you have Johnny Velasquez, Javier Castellano, you got the Ortiz brother, Tyler Gaff. I mean, there's like so many good riders. But it's fun. I think it makes all of us better. And it's fun to ride with all those great riders.
PA Bred, I think we've built a brand at this point.
It's excitement at every step.
Roses for Deborah just set a new track record.
On average, for the past decade, Pennsylvania paid over $28 million a year in breeders' awards, restricted races, and owner bonuses. Plus, PA Bred shine on the world's biggest stage. Just three states have bred more Breeders' Cup winners. Learn more at PABred.com.
Be a smarter better with XSpeed TV. The best horses. With thousands of exclusive morning workouts. All at your fingertips and delivered right into your inbox. Everything you need to be informed. Be smart. Bet smart with XSpeed TV.
Our next interview subject, you may love him and agree with him, or you may find him annoying and disagreeable. But without question, Mike Rapole is passionate about the sport. He is never shy about expressing his opinions on anything. And like him or not, Mike is always interesting. We talked to Mike
about fierceness after fierceness beat Torpedo Anna in that famous Traverse Stakes. And we also talked to Mike about some of the changes he's looking to effect with his newly created National Thoroughbred Association.
Welcome in now our Green Group guest of the week. And you know this fella because he wins an awful lot of races and is found in the winner's circle an awful lot of times. That's Mike Rapoli, the owner of, among others, Fierceness, who won the Traverse Stakes. Mike, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us. You have had so much success in your career in racing, but 96, 97% of those horses were horses you bought at sales. How did it feel different that a homebred won? And is that then, are you a little bit more proud of this accomplishment than maybe the one that wins that you went out and spent $1 million for at Keeneland?
Well, Bill, I hope you okay if I say hello to Randy first because he's also on. Randy, how you doing? Bill, how are you? Bill, it's first of all, winning the Travers is probably top five race for anybody that is in this racing game. And, I've done it in 2011 with Stay Thirsty. And now again, this weekend, I'm still on cloud nine. As far as it being a homebred versus a yearling purchase or a two-year-old purchase, there was a lot of reflection prior to the race and a little reflection post-race. Nuna Mia was a horse that I bought, one of my first horses I bought in a sale in 2000, I think seven for like 200,000. She's named after my grandmother, my grandmother in Italian. And I bred her, I bred Nona Mia to Stay Thirsty. And I got this filly called Nona Bella. And what's your beautiful grandmother. So you're talking about the first stage being 2007. Stay Thirsty was a 2008. Nona Bella probably was a 2014. And now to come here and breed Nona Bella to City of Light, which I have a 10% stake. I mean, this is, 17, 18 years in the creation or making of Fierceness. So when you start to think about starting the game, with first thoughts in 2004 and 2005, probably didn't win a race till 2006. And now you fast forward 20 years and there's, not only do you own the mare, you own the grand mare, and you race them both. And Stay Thirsty when you're your first Traverse, and he's the grandsire. A kind of big reflection of being in my early 30s to now mid 50s, and my grandmother being around for the races. And I told my daughter Joya, she asked me if I, on Friday, Dad, did we ever win the Traverse? And I said, no, I won the Travers in 2011, but you weren't here, so you haven't won the Travers. So I got two, she's got one, and it feels great. I mean, it really does have a lot more meaning, over the last week, Bill and Randy, than I kind of really thought about it, say 6 months ago.
So given that emotional involvement, more so with this particular horse, how difficult was it for you, all the slings and arrows that Fierceness took after the Kentucky Derby, and even the skepticism? I mean, he was almost, he was 7-2 or something like that in the Travers. The skepticism that he'd be able to put two races together back to back the way he did. How tough was that for you to listen to all that?
Randy, listen, as far as tough, very tough. But, I pride myself on, I bought a sneaker company, apparel company called No Bull. You know what that stands for. And it's about mental toughness and a tough mentality. So, listen, life is about adversity and life is about ups and downs. I mean, I scratched two Derby favorites. I don't know what can be tougher than Uncle Mo or Forte, winning and losing a race. I mean, that happens every single day. But this horse probably was more baffling for Todd. Todd has never had a horse this talented one race. And then all of a sudden you go from 110 buyer to an 80 buyer, and it's an every other start thing. So, listen, I mean, you and Bill have been around this game a long time, and we know there's a lot more lows than there are highs. So anytime you're having a high in this game, it's hard to feel bad about having lows. But, I really feel great for Todd, who really put a lot of effort into every horse, and he's been around for over 25 years. But this horse in particular, I joked with him the other day, he's going to go down in history as the trainer who got Fierceness beat three times. That's going to be his legacy. So, I mean, he did an amazing job and the horse ran super.
I was a little worried about you after the race when the Fox camera showed the box and I didn't see you. You were like collapsed back into a chair.
But you know what? At the quarter pole, I thought we were going to win by three. At the eighth pole, I thought we were going to win by 2.5. At the 16th pole, I thought we were going to win by 1.5. At the 132nd pole, I thought we were going to lose by a length. So it seems like to Peter Anna, let's just give her all the praise out there. Pop. I mean, Philly against boys, this was Zenyatta blame. When Uncle Mo won its when his 2-year-old juvenile, that was the blame Zenyatta year. And to watch blame Zenyatta, it gave me a little bit of a feeling of 2010 with these two. What a great Philly, 3-year-old colt, 3-year-old Philly champions. It was an unbelievable race. But honestly, there was a time I really thought Torpedo Anna had him. And I think Fierceness dug in just a little bit more right before the wire and said, you're not going to get by me. And it was, for a race to have all the hype that this has had and people were talking, it really is why we love the sport so much. I mean, it lived up to the hype, man. It was special.
Mike, and I'm glad you brought that up about Torpedo Anna, because I know you love the history of the game and you're a sportsman. She almost beat you on a day where your horse ran the race of his life. And I saw you and Kenny McPeak were all smiles after the race. I can't blame Kenny for being happy with a loss because she ran so well. What did you say to one another and what impressions did you come away with her?
I've been in that position, and to to be as, to take a loss like that as well as Kenny and Team Torpedo Anna took it, I congratulated them. But in a way, it's uncomfortable to say, hey, we won, congratulations, and hey, you ran a great race. And the biggest compliment I could give him, I said, please keep this filly with the girls. I don't want to do this again. Like, please, like that. I mean, that's the biggest compliment I can give him. Was like, I don't want to face her anymore. I mean, she ran an amazing race. I mean, I've tried Nest in the Belmont, ran second to Moldonigal. That second I didn't take too hard because I also won Moldonigal, so it wasn't that bad. But I've watched Todd with Rags to Riches before this. It's done once in a while, and applaud the connections for taking a chance. And she did nothing but, she could have won the Alabama by 7. And, she was second by a head to 2-year-old champ and possibly 3-year-old champ.
And now it's, if all goes well, it's in Todd You Trust to map out a plan going forward. And I guess that plan is to train him up to the Breeders' Cup Classic? Is that kind of set in stone?
Yeah. I mean, Randy, if you would ask us after the Jim Dandy, we were telling you that he won't race until the Pennsylvania Derby. So that lasted for 12 hours. but this one, we're sure. I mean, he's probably not going to work for probably 6 weeks before the Classic. He'll get some time off. Came out of the race great. That was a big surprise for Todd. Fierceness took the Derby. Probably lost 75 to 100 pounds, wasn't himself for about 2 or 3 weeks, just needed to, have that mid-year, rest. And I think, everybody knows me as only aggressive. I mean, I have a term out there, patiently aggressive. And, I knew we couldn't run him in the Preakness and not even the Belmont. So we gave him time, and Todd did what he had to do, and Fierceness just responded. And I really believe we have a horse that's, I really believe this is the best race he's ever run in his career. And I really believe there's a chance that his next one might be even better.
Mike, if we're talking about this race next year at this time, maybe we're talking about Menti winning the Travers. That, of course, is the full brother to Fierceness, ran the one time at Saratoga, and we haven't seen him since. What's the update on him?
He's worked the last 2 weeks incredibly. He had a fever, and when he got his fever, it was from a puncture wound, and it wound up that Todd caught this early. He had acute laminitis, and
whoa,
he was away for about 10 days, and you know, Todd did, thank God Todd and the doctors got him there quickly. Danielle Bricker, who's on my team, she went to visit him 3 times a day, and it got a little nerve-wracking, and that this horse rebounded really incredibly well to come back and work 3 times. I mean, this is the behind-the-scenes story that a lot of people don't see. And, you know, they say, oh, you know, sometimes you're going to retire a horse too early, or come on, just do it for the fans. But they don't understand the stress and anxiety that Todd Pletcher or my team or even I wake up to every day with. All right, you know, I mean, you know, like I would ask Todd, I'd wake up and ask Todd how fierceness was before I would check on Joyer and Maria. And no disrespect to my wife and Maria, they'd be sleeping, so they were okay. Me and fierceness weren't. So there is a lot of that stress that goes in between. And, you know, when you care as much as we do and most owners and trainers do about the horses, they're family. And, you know, there's you feel the pressure for them, you know, to perform, you know, like, so, you know, men, like this happens, like this is a tough part of the game that people don't see or don't understand. And you know what, we're lucky he's alive, because this could have went one way or the other. That's what laminitis does. And for him to rebound like this, like, you know, I mean, we feel great. And he was up at Saratoga, spent 10 days in the clinic, got back, galloped for 2 weeks, and, you know, and shout out to Danielle, who is amazing. And she slept with the horse for in his stall for a couple weeks. So maybe that helped a little bit. Wow. Getting him back to, you know, where he is today.
Maybe this will be another Lady Eli story. That's really something. Yeah. So the last time we had you on the podcast, we not only talked about fierceness and about your horses, we talked about your new initiative, the National Thoroughbred Association. Give us an update. We haven't read much about it lately. What's percolating with you?
You know, it's probably 9 months in right now, maybe 10. Pat Cummings is in Japan right now for an event out there. And, you know, I've learned a lot, Bill and Randy, about this game. I've dug in as deep as I can on, you know, not only the ownership side, but this, you know, the track side, the ABC committees that we have out there, stallions, the sales end, thoroughbred aftercare, the two-year-old sales. And, you know, I mean, Bill and I speak once in a while, just like me and you, Randy. And, you know, although I asked Bill honestly what he thought, you know, he was rooting for me, but he thought there's a low percent chance that I can make a difference. And he said it was nothing against me. It's just the way the industry is, you know, is formed and shaped. But yeah, I think we're making a lot more progress than people think. First of all, there's more talk over the last 10 months than there's ever been. You know, many people agree with what I'm saying. The only negative feedback I get is they don't like the style. And you know what? Other styles haven't worked for 40 years. Mm. If you can show me a style that works, where you just come in and you hold hands and you sing Kumbaya, and I'll do it. That was my first option. But this is a game where 90% of the people want changes, but not the 10% that they do. Please, let's start with the other 90%. And it's become pretty selfish. And I have to look myself in the mirror. You know, if I want to be in this game 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 25 years from now, I have to feel good about the sport that I'm in. And right now, I don't feel good about things like horse aftercare. I don't feel good about two-year-old sales. I don't feel good about how the sport is undermined by people inside our industry. I don't feel good about the committees that are making the calls. And I don't feel good about the selfishness. So, listen, as much as I love winning races, I've been in the game for 20 years. To me, it's more important over the next 5 years that I have a lead role in helping change the game for the better, for not the next 5 months, but the next 5 to 25 years. And I really believe I'd rather do that than win a third Travers. And the first initiative that Pat and I are taking on, which you would have thought was a simple one to conquer, was horse aftercare. Oh, that, come on, everyone loves aftercare. Of course. When I dig in and see that the TAA, it's been around for 10 years, only raises $3.5 million a year, and that most of these agencies and horse rescue and aftercare facilities have to beg and plead, you know, for money. Like, you know, and all these millions are being traded back and forth at the sales, races, $10 million race, $6 million race, $20 million race Dubai. And we can't, the day that horse is born, you know, doesn't matter if it changes hands once or 20 times in its career. We have to know that that horse is taken care of for the next 25 years of its life. And until somebody puts a system and process in place, and honestly, the things that I'm asking for Bill and Randy are really about little breakage, you know, 0.0025% if you buy or sell a horse at an auction, which would raise $9 million, okay? So if you buy a horse for $100,000, you pay $250. If you sell a horse for $100,000, you pay $250. And then the sales center chips in 0.001, which is $100. So you're talking about $600,000 on every $100,000 transaction. On a $1 million transaction, it's $6,000. And I still haven't had Fasig sign on. I still don't have Keeneland sign on. And I still don't have OBS. I'm not saying that Boyd and Shannon are not going to do this, because I'm initiating this on January 1st. You know, I'm going to say this, and this is where people don't like me at times. With or without him, this is going to happen. You know, the stallion farms, you know, Uncle Mo gets bred 200 times. We have to donate one breeding of Uncle Mo a year for over 100 breedings. So that's 150,000. Justify 300, Intermischief 250. You know, stallion farm, that would come out to another $4 million. That's $10 million just in stallion fees, one out of 200. Randy, let's do the math. 200 times 150,000, that's 30 million. I think 150,000 is okay, right? You know, so we can't do this anymore. And that nobody, and this is where I've been brutally tough and deservingly on the jockey club. You're here to make the game better and move it forward. These are simple initiatives. If we can't do it aftercare, you know what? Then this game has no chance. And you know what? It's unfortunate, but I feel like I have to almost force change. And I hope that doesn't sound arrogant or cocky, but listen, if we care about this game 5 to 25 years from now, someone's going to have to be the bad guy or the disruptor. And you know what? If someone has to be the asshole, sign me up. I'm actually pretty good at it. I can actually play asshole very well. And I'll enjoy doing it, you know? So that's it. And I feel that's my focus right now. For 18 to 40 year old, I'm 55. I fell in love with this game when I was 13, 14 years old. You know, like, is it going to be around for the 15 year old? Is it going to be around for the 25 year old, the 35 year old? I got a lot of concerns. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Well, we want to thank Mike Rapoli so much for joining us here as the Green Group Guest of the Week on the Thoroughbred Daily News Writers Room podcast. Congratulations, Mark, on a brilliant win by Fierceness in what is absolutely the race of the year so far. Well done, and we'll see Fierceness in the Breeders' Cup.
Thank you, guys.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Perhaps one of the most interesting stories, and Randy can agree or disagree, but one of the most interesting stories of 2024 was City of Troy's foray to the Breeders' Cup to have a tilt at the Breeders' Cup Classic on dirt. And one of our most interesting interviews was with his trainer, Aidan O'Brien. And he sat down with us in October to talk about how he was prepping his superstar three-year-old for the race of a lifetime. And Randy, we're so glad you're still here, even after Coolmore tried to sniper you.
Well, we're delighted on this week's Thoroughbred Daily News Writers Room podcast, a very special guest, none other than Aidan O'Brien, one of the greatest trainers of all time and somebody who's going to probably make a lot of noise in the U.S. in the Breeders' Cup races coming up. Aidan, thanks for joining us. And you know, all the buzz for City of Troy has reached our shores. We've heard about how good he is. We've heard about what you think of him. But when did you start thinking about the Breeders' Cup Classic for him and why the dirt instead of turf?
Yeah, I suppose it was always on our mind. Obviously, Bill, we've never won a Classic. We've been placed in it a good few times. It's obviously a race that we'd love to win, but we know that you need an exceptional horse to do it, really. Obviously, he's by Justify, which makes it very exciting and always made it look like he could be very special for us. He's pacey, he's hardy, he's stays, he's determined. He has all the things we think could have and he could have to make it happen. But obviously it's a big ask to run on the dirt first time and a horse that's not trained on it. But we've went close with horses before, obviously, like a Giant's Causeway and those horses.
So you say he's not trained on it yet. This is pretty interesting, I think. We find it over here fascinating. The plans going forward, the immediate future for City of Troy, the September 20th workout at Southwell with an American starting gate. With other, explain to us the thoughts behind that and the logistics involved in getting it done.
Yeah, sure. I suppose Randy, he'll fly over. It'll be like a race day for him. It'll be an artificial surface. It's not dirt, but it's as close as probably we can get it from here. And we don't want too big a change too quickly either. So it's a little bit of a change off of what he is used to. Obviously it'll be out at American Gates with horses. We'll probably go a mile. And we'll probably do as much as we can to have him as ready as we can without changing his whole regime every day. I suppose that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do a little gently, really, rather than one big shock. And obviously then the next one would be more severe for him.
How many horses do you anticipate working with him?
I suppose between five and eight, we wow. think. Yeah, so we'll probably... So it'll depend on what way it'll be. But we think we'd probably need at least five.
So, Aidan, let me get this straight. You're going to load five or eight horses onto the Ballydoyle plane, take them to Southall, and you're also taking your American starting gate. When did you get an American starting gate at Ballydoyle? And can you just explain to everybody the difference between the English and the American ones? And why?
Yeah, they're bigger, they're stronger, they're closer. They go more to the ground and obviously the bell. And there is a different feel to them. We've had them a long time now, but has made a big difference to us when we go to America with the horses. It's a whole different feel. The stalls look bigger, but they're not. They're tighter because the sides come in closer than our stalls do here. So, I suppose we're always trying to improve. And when we do go over to try have as much practice done for whatever situation we have to deal with, I suppose. Zoe.
Will you use a handler? Because I know that's been problematic in the past because you might not have one, but there'll be a guy next door that could spook your horse.
Yeah, we probably will. Our horses are very used to it all the time. From the time they start going into stalls, we treat them like the way you treat your horses in America, with a handler, goes in there, sits with them, and like all the horses, we do that all the time, so that if or when we go to America, there's no real change.
Would the plan be to expose him to kickback in this particular?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the surface we're going to work on it. Ryan said there's not much kickback anyway. I'm not sure. My experience of kickback either. They either take it or they don't, and obviously you do your best not to be in kickback. I think that's the way I think all trainers approach it in America. If you're in the situation, you're getting it, you can't do anything about it. But in an ideal world, you don't want to be getting it, really. Sure you don't.
Now, still several weeks to go, but Aidan, City of Troy will be the headliner. Can you just, at this point in time, can you tell us of other horses you're thinking of bringing to the Breeders' Cup?
I suppose it's early, but we would have a lot of horses. Obviously, we have the filly Content. She won the Yorkshire Oaks, and then we obviously would have 2-year-olds, Bill. We always like to take a colt and a filly, and I suppose Whistle Jacket is another one. Is it possible? He won the Marnie. He's going to run in the Middle Park next. So all those type of horses, really. Obviously, come that time of the year, who's well? But like one thing we have learned, the horses have to be very good, have to be top class to go there. So it's like, obviously, we approach it like all group ones, that if they're good enough, we'll take them and try. And if they're not, we won't.
So another question I have on the City of Troy topic, you know, we've seen over the years, you've seen over the years, this, you know, the late, unfortunate late super sire Galileo. The form of Galileo sired horses typically didn't translate that well from grass to dirt, right?
Yes.
The dam of City of Troy, Together Forever, is a daughter of Galileo, with theatrical also on the in that pedigree. So it's almost exclusively turf. And you've got Justify, obviously, as the sire. Does this horse remind you physically, the way he runs, a little bit more of Justify maybe than Together Forever?
I think he's always been, Randy, that way he goes forward. He went forward in all his runs as a two-year-old, and then he kind of blew up on us in the Guineas. His first run, I probably had him too fresh. And after that, we kind of had to take our time with him here. Obviously, the style of racing is a little bit slower here. But I think naturally he's aggressive if you let him be. We haven't, after the first day, we didn't leave him be. But obviously, we had it in our minds, if everything went well the last day, he would be going here next. So we Ryan went forward on him, and he did latch on. And I know, knowing the horse, he wanted to go forward more the next day. And if that was the case, that would suit your race, we think.
How good do you feel the Sons of Justify are worldwide? Because it seems like he's got it all. We see him running on dirt and turf over here. He's done well in Australia. He seems to be flying over in Ireland. What is it about him? Because physically looking at him, and I spent a lot of time with him in Southern California, he just looks like your big burly dirt horse. But he's got that.
Yeah. Like when we saw him first, like he looked a different breed of turbot altogether. Like he looked like a big quarter horse, really.
Right.
Yeah, that's when we saw him as the first, like, we could not believe the amount of muscle and the power and the scope and the strength that he had. And then to be able to go get a mile and a half in the Belmont, like, it was freakish, really. So, really, he's a different kind of a breed of turbot than we've seen ever before, we think. His stock of a lot of class. They're very high cruisers. They're very genuine. They're very like Galileos, but they have more speed. You know, but like, sure, I suppose what he did as a racehorse was just out of this world, like a horse that didn't run at two to win the Triple Crown and be that size, you know. So we just, we hoped, like obviously the boss obviously saw him and he wanted him, and that's why he wanted he was just a different breed of turbot altogether. And that's what we're so excited about him, the way he's working here on the grass. And like, he looks like a massive, big, powerful dirt horse, doesn't he, really? So, you know, you're absolutely right.
We always look forward here to seeing the Coolmore horses for the Breeders' Cup. The Breeders' Cup would not even be close to what it is right now without John Magner and the rest of Coolmore and the horses that you've trained coming over here, such sporting gestures year after year after year. How much do you enjoy Del Mar as a site for the Breeders' Cup?
Yeah, no, sure. We love it. Obviously, we love walking on the beach. It's unique, isn't it, really? Like, obviously, when we go to the Breeders' Cup, it's a big, it's great for us to go over and experience it. I think you have to go and experience it to really believe it. The atmosphere and the hype, and, you know, it's just very special, really, that time of the year, and all the best horses are there. It's the ultimate test, really.
And it's interesting because when you come to America, you think, you know, you kind of go in and just mind your own business. But you've talked about how much you've learned from American trainers, in particular Bob Baffert and Wesley Ward. What lessons, what have they, have you talked to them, or you just follow them from afar? And what have you learned from them?
I'm not sure. Obviously, we've learned a lot from them, and always do and try, and obviously weigh in as well, you know, so. Like every time we go, we learn a lot, and like obviously we would be friendly with all the American trainers, and like they're always very forthcoming with information what we should be doing and what they do, and obviously we see everything that they do as well, and everything now is very public anyway, and it's broadcasted to everybody, which is a big help, I think, to everybody. Listen, information kind of is all the key, is always the key, and experience of watching what they do and what we should do if we want to be successful or over there with you, really.
What's left for Aidan O'Brien? You have won just about everything, aside from the Breeders' Cup Classic. Like, what are one of your goals that you're like, I really would love to win this race?
Yeah, no, not really. We never approach anything like that, Zoe. We always try to do our best with every horse, take it as it comes. And I think if you start doing that, it just becomes too difficult and too much pressure, you know. So we try and do our best with every horse to get the best out of them and try and win whatever races we would like to win. But it's some races are very difficult. And, like, obviously, like it's the Classic, we haven't won. We've never won a Classic, you know, and we ran very good horses in it. So it's very, very difficult. And we've tried very hard. But so all we can do is try again, really.
Would you try the Kentucky Derby? Would you?
Yeah, we have had runners. It's very tough in this part of the world because maybe the preparation isn't as tough to get into it. I think a lot of the horses in the Kentucky Derby, it's a tough preparation and they're really ready for it when it does come. Like, we wouldn't be able to probably give them that preparation over here. But like everything, it's not impossible, we think. But you just have to have the right horse and you don't win it with a second racer, really.
So on that same general topic, Aidan, one of the big stories of American racing this year, especially this summer, has been that Godolphin and Charlie Appleby have sent basically a full-time string to stay in the United States. I think they've run 19 different horses this year. They've made almost $5 million in purses. Is that something you think that your bosses, the Mr. Magner and Tabor and Smith, might possibly be looking at for the future?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, obviously, we have a Ballydial here, and we have all kinds of gallops, and it's a plane journey away, really. That's all. It's very safe environment here. I don't know whether the lads have looked at that, but I don't know whether they will or they won't. But it's not a long trip across the sea, really.
Being the hard-hitting journalist that I am, I'm going to ask you a real tough question, if you don't mind, Aidan.
No problem.
What's the story with the dog?
Oh, we're minding her for Anna, and Anna is in America at the moment. It's San Francisco. And she's missing Anna. There's two of them there, so that's what's going on. And anybody goes by the door, they think it's Anna. So
right. We're all dog fans. We enjoy the sound effect. That's really nice.
Well done. Well done. Well done.
I've got one more question.
No problem.
Aside, let's get off horses. Does Aidan O'Brien have a bucket list of a place he'd like to see, like to go? Do you want to jump out of an aeroplane? Is there something that you want to do other than horses?
No, sure. Like, obviously there's a lot of stuff, and I don't do much ever. I go racing and I go to the tracks, and I don't get time really to do anything really. That's just the way my life is. It's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and if we fail, we've done our best and we can accept it. But if we fail and we haven't, it's just harder, you know. So the time will come, I presume, when that'll happen. But at the moment, like, it's full on, and it has been for 25-30 years, you know. So but listen, hopefully I see those places on telly at the moment.
We hear that from trainers all the time over here, also, Aidan. Like I remember talking to Bob Baffert, and when he had his unfortunate suspension a couple of years ago, a couple of summers ago, he took his family on a big vacation, and he said it was the first time he'd ever been able to do it. When's the last time you just went on a vacation, left it all behind?
Yes.
A week, 2 weeks?
Yes.
When?
No, so we've never done it, really. We go to the Breeders' Cup every year, and that's and then we go from Breeders' Cup. We usually go to Barbados for a week to meet the lads in Barbados. But this year we won't be because we have Augustus Rodin. The plan is for him to go to Japan after his next run. So we'll be trying to get back here as quick as we can. So hopefully sometime we'll see those places.
I think the Sandy Lane Hotel in Barbados qualifies as a nice vacation.
Exactly.
Aiden, before we let you go, I have one last question for you. This is the first time, I believe, that you've run horses at Kentucky Downs this year. And, you know, what are your plans in the future going forward? Will we see you participate even more? And how much of a buzz is it creating in Europe with these just unbelievable purses?
Yeah, no, I think it's unbelievable, really. And that's what will bring horses. The purses will bring horses. And that's what's happening. And I think everybody's talking about it. And I think it's only going to become more popular and more popular. Everybody wants to be there. Listen, obviously, everyone knows training horses is an expensive operation and has to be funded. And for maybe horses that, especially geldings or colts, that maybe are not good enough to go to stud, it's a big outlet. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone is talking about it all over the world, you know. So, and I think it's going to get more and more popular, really.
Very good.
Meanwhile, I volunteer to take your place at Sandy Lane Hotel next year when you can't make it.
Maybe we can do the podcast from Sandy Lane.
That's on my bucket list, actually.
Yeah, well done.
All right. Well, Aiden, we want to thank you for joining us today on the TDN Writers Room podcast. Best of luck with City of Troy. Keep up the good work. You're having a typical great year, and it was a joy to talk to you, and we'll see you at the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, look forward to it, Bill.
Thanks.
Thanks, Zoe. Thanks, everybody.
Well, that's a wrap on this special edition, the best of the TDN Writers Room. Happy holidays to everybody. I want to thank my cohorts, Randy Moss, Zoe Cadman. I want to thank Sue Finley, our executive producer, and also our producers and editors, Katie Petruniak, Anthony LaRocca, and Aaliyah LaRocca. It's been a fun year, and we're going to have a great 2025. Happy holidays, everybody. Enjoy.